Welcome back to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Governor Snyder has signed a fairly controversial bill into law that puts limits on local officials' ability to campaign for millages and other local ballot questions. Local officials, including a number from the Lansing area, say that the new law amounts to a gag order during the 60 days preceding an election. One of those local officials is Rebecca Bahar Cook. She's an Ingham County commissioner. She says it's an effort by anti-tax conservatives to shift the balance in local elections so voters are more likely to reject millage requests.
If I can't talk about why we need to put more money into 911 or what the library system looks like, if I can't show them that we have a valid reason for it, why would they vote for it?
Governor Snyder says that's not the intent of the law, and he called on the legislature to quickly adopt a bill to clarify it. We'll keep an eye on it. Welcome back to our program. It is Thursday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last September, the federal government wrapped up a four-year investigation involving Michigan State University. It looked into how MSU handles complaints of sexual harassment and assault. The university had begun reforms before the final report. Still, the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights last year cited MSU for non-compliant grievance procedures. It also said the school took too long to respond to reports of sexual assault and harassment. It suggested the result was a sexually hostile environment on campus for numerous students and staff. Now today, Michigan State's efforts to create a more responsive system and a safer campus continue. Our first two guests are in the thick of that effort. Both have just begun working at Michigan State. We welcome Andy Durajaye, the director of MSU's recently launched Office of Institutional Equity. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
And Jessica Norris is Michigan State's new Title IX coordinator. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a controversial few years here at MSU and many other schools as well regarding sexual assault and harassment and compliance with the OCR and Title IX. Talk to us, please, about your short list of priorities as you're both getting started in your new positions. Jessica, what about you? What's really top of mind here at the beginning for you?
Well, for me, top of mind is compliance and, working to ensure that all elements of our Title IX program are compliant with federal and state laws. Second of all, I would say is listening, understanding not just how that program can be compliant, but how we can best be meeting the needs of our students. So really understanding the concerns that are out there in the campus community and ways that we can enhance and improve our program.
Andy, what about you?
My number one things I want to do first is speeding up the process, so to speak. So finding a way that we can efficiently respond and investigate complaints of sexual assault and sexual harassment. That's the major thing. And I think the next thing is developing the Office of Institutional Equity so that we can serve the greater community, not only issues with Title IX and sexual assault and sexual violence, but all equity issues that arise here at Michigan State University.
Just for some perspective, we'll share with our listeners that in 2013, at least, there were 159 reports of sexual assaults on the state's public and private college campuses. That's the entire state of Michigan, but that represents a 62% increase from 2001. So life on campus appears to be changing, or at least these incidents are being reported an awful lot more often. We're led to believe that. Andy, you touched on the issue of responsiveness. This is arguably, I think, one of the most maybe the most serious ongoing criticism leveled at the university, responding sooner to complaints of harassment and assault. Jessica, let me ask you this. If your office receives allegations of an incident, how long do you have to respond with an investigative report?
It's 60 days under the OCR guidelines.
60 days under OCR. MSU has an even stricter standard than that, though. Do I have that right?
So the standard is still 60 days. And so one of the distinctions that people often don't understand is the 60-day response that OCR mentions is not only the investigation person, but it's the entire timeline of a case. So from the initial report all the way until the final resolution. So if it goes through an appeal or deals with student conduct. And so a lot of universities are in a difficult position in doing that and finding ways to respond within those time frames.
Well, I mean, we do routinely hear of investigations taking much longer than that. Is 60 days not enough time?
Well, you know, so my background working in OCR and knowing that at OCR we took longer than 60 days to actually investigate these complaints, I think it is difficult to respond in 60 days. Do I think it's impossible? No, I don't think it is. I think that, you know, we had the people in place currently here at the university where we can work to make sure that we are able to complete our investigations in the allotted time frames.
But would you argue with 100 days to respond to these things to fully adjudicate them?
So I would think
I would think that would there would be an advantage to that.
Well, I think that 60 days for what we're being asked to do is very difficult. So I definitely could make an argument that 100 days would probably be a better time frame to things do. You know, the standards that OCR sets out is not only that the investigations need to be, you know, efficient and timely, but they also need to be thorough and equitable. And so in my opinion, you know, I've worked in doing investigations for quite some time. I think to do a thorough investigation based on the numbers that we're getting and based on the awareness that we're getting through the programs that Jessica's implementing and that are being implemented around the country, you know, more time would be a better thing to have, but we don't have it currently. And so we have to work with the guidelines that have been set for us.
It suggests perhaps a lack of resources, a lack of personnel. Would you say you could use more resources and more personnel, Jessica?
Well, I would say who couldn't use more resources and personnel? Certainly, that's a component of my role, and part of what I've been charged with doing is evaluating not just the resources on the investigation side, but also our resources supporting students through our advocacy and counseling programs, our prevention and education programs. So that will certainly be something I will be looking at and making recommendations on if we see that there is a high need.
But are both of you working on the assumption that the 60-day time frame is not going to change?
Yes, it will not change.
Okay. President Simon commented when the OCR's final report was released. She said, quote, "We have to work through how we take the time to do thorough investigations, suggesting a due process, the importance of due process, yet maintain urgency and compassion by completing them as quickly as possible." How might the process that you're working with today be tightened up?
Well, I think some of the things that we have to do and we are doing currently is making sure we have our internal guidelines that are set. And I think prior to, we didn't have any sort of internal guidelines and timeframes. And so now what we've done in the office is we've set strict timeframes with which our investigators are supposed to complete certain portions of the investigation process. And I think having those in place and being able to, you know, hold them accountable and give them opportunity to do what they need to do with kind of clear bright line rules and bright line standards that we want to employ in the office has been really, really effective, and I think it'll be helpful going forward.
But what does that do to due process? To what extent does that jeopardize due process?
Well, I don't think it does, because in the timeframes we've built internally, we have due process built in it. So we have timeframes with which we need to talk to both parties, with which we need to talk to witnesses from both parties, with which we need to review evidence. So I don't think it affects due process. I think we're still going to be able to do what we need to do from a due diligence standpoint of talking to all the parties and all the relevant witnesses and doing a robust investigation within those timeframes.
Andy Durajaye is the director of MSU's recently launched Office of Institutional Equity. Jessica Norris is Michigan State's new Title IX coordinator. We're talking about MSU's ongoing efforts to be more responsive to situations involving sexual assault and harassment. And we'll get to other forms of discrimination before the conversation is through. Appeals mean delays. Is there a way to speed up the appeals process, streamline that in some way, again, without compromising due process?
Well, certainly those are things that we'll be looking at. Having been on campus for a week now, it's probably early for me to say exactly what opportunities there
might
be.
We are getting to you both pretty early in the game. And we appreciate your coming. You two are still getting to know each other, and we'll be clear about that.
But that is something that we're working closely with not only Andy's office and his team, but also with student conduct to track our timelines and see where our issues are with regard to timeliness and seeing if we can find ways to make the process more efficient. So certainly we'll be doing that, and it won't be a one-time exercise. This is something that is going to be part of our program going forward, that we're going to be looking for opportunities to continuously improve.
You've been at this a while in particular, Andy. I mean, are appeals an increasing part of the landscape here?
They are. So as awareness as awareness is raised around Title IX related issues, appeals are going to go up, because right now, you know, there are certain people who individually feel they're not being treated fairly in the process. And so every time we file a complaint, because of the notoriety it gets, there's going to be an equal amount of notoriety that goes to the appeal process and, you know, the rights of the respondent, so to speak. So I think that the trend is we will see more and more appeals as we see more and more allegations of sexual assault, sexual misconduct.
Andy and Jessica, you hear critics comment that universities generally are just not equipped to resolve or to basically adjudicate, for lack of a better word, these incidents. What do you make of criticism like that?
So what I would say historically, I would agree with that criticism historically from, you know, in past practice. But what I think, you know, universities like MSU and different universities around the country developing offices of institutional equity where they're able to focus specifically on these things, I think what we have in place, we're taking the right steps to better equip us to be able to handle these type of situations. So I think that the future is bright, and I think going forward we will be able to equip and we will be able to handle these type of issues.
Let's talk about the role of law enforcement here. Jessica, could campuses use expanded access to law enforcement? Talk to us about the relationship between what goes on the campus and actual law enforcement.
Well, there is a strong connection between law enforcement and campus Title IX programs. And here at MSU, I would say we're on the forefront of that. There are strong working relationships with the police department. We have a special victims unit, which is staffed with detectives who are specially trained to investigate the sensitive sexual violence cases. We also have memorandums of understanding with local law enforcement agencies. And oftentimes, there are opportunities to share training resources and participate in programs and educational opportunities together, and to incorporate local law enforcement and campus law enforcement in many of the meetings and the plans. So I would say that Michigan State is really well positioned in that regard, but that is a trend across the country that more and more universities are looking to build those relationships with local law enforcement to, you know, increase information sharing and share resources as well.
Is that underdeveloped right now, though? Is there a productive relationship between what you're doing and local law enforcement, or does that need work?
Well, I would say I'm aware of the relationship with campus police, and I know that they're heavily involved in many of the meetings and committees. So I think that's very well developed. I'm still very new and haven't been involved in meetings with local law enforcement yet, having only been here a week. But if that's not developed, that's something that would be on my priority list.
And I would say I think it is developed. I've had an opportunity to sit in on a couple of meetings with local law enforcement. And so we've gone through, in conjunction with MSU PD, the Office of Institutional Equity, and different stakeholders around campus, doing training with local law enforcement and having conversations. So I think it's definitely a communication is present, and I think it's going to continue to grow as, you know, Jessica is able to get more things going here at the university.
There are differing views on the involvement of law enforcement here. Some say more of these incidents belong with the police, in part because there are critics who say that university punishments amount to a slap on the wrist too often. But some complainants say law enforcement aggravates the situation. Is that a tough tightrope to walk here?
I think it's definitely a tough tightrope to walk. I think, you know, what, you know, I guess the different sides don't always understand is the requirements the university are under Title IX, regardless of, you know, if they think that, you know, the university policy is a slap on the wrist, the law enforcement policy is too heavy-handed, we still have a duty to respond. And so we're going to have to respond regardless, unless, you know, something changes with the law that I don't see changing in the foreseeable future.
The OIE has scheduled what you're calling a town meeting for the 28th. On your website, you call this a follow-up to recent events that have occurred at institutions of higher education across the country regarding discrimination and harassment. Which incidents are those, and tell us more about this town
meeting?
So,
you know, recently everyone knows about the big incidents that occurred at University of Missouri. We also know about the incidents occurred around at Yale University dealing with racial bias and racial discrimination. So we've had some town halls here at the university where we're discussing the process of filing a discrimination complaint, the idea of what's the difference between discrimination and a bias incident. And so this town hall is just an opportunity to continue the dialogue with our various stakeholders on campus.
We would like to have you both back after you've been at this a while longer. You're at the, you know, as I said, you're in the thick of this challenge. It's a big job. It's an important job. We appreciate your joining us here at the beginning of your 10 years here, but we'd love to have you back, and we appreciate it very much. We want to thank Andy Durajaye, the director of MSU's recently launched Office of Institutional Equity, also Jessica Norris, who is Michigan State's new Title IX coordinator. Thanks to both of you, and good luck.
Thank you
for having us.
Coming up on Current State, almost 4 years ago, MSU adopted an energy transition plan that detailed sustainable energy goals for the university to work toward. We'll speak with Wolfgang Bauer, MSU professor and senior consultant in the Office of the Vice President, about the progress MSU has made on the sustainable energy front so far. That story and more still to come on Current State. Some of the world's top music acts will have Michigan tour stops this year. Scott Pohl is here with a preview of 2016's biggest concert. So what do we see on the horizon here, Scott?
Well, it should be a big year, Mark. And as we do from time to time, we turn to Lansing State Journal Things to Do reporter and music columnist Ann Erickson to talk about the Michigan music scene. The concerts she chose for us to talk about are so big, Mark, that some have already sold out weeks and even months in advance. City in Color will be at the intersection in Grand Rapids on January 30th. Now, I confess I don't know much about City in Color. What can you tell us?
This is the side project of Alexis on Fire's Dallas Green. It's a very alternative folk sound, really cool sound, so that should be a good show.
Check this out. It's called If I Should Go Before You, City in Color.
If you should cross the wild.
One of the, I guess you might think of it as a farewell concert tour this year, Black Sabbath is going out, and it sure looks like a farewell tour. It's called The End Tour.
The End, that's for sure.
It's The End. Now, this is original members, Ozzy Osbourne, Tommy Iommi, and Geezer Butler, and they're going to be at the Palace of Auburn Hills on February 19th. And they're also going to be back later in the summer at the DTE Energy Music Theater on August 31st. So there are two opportunities to see Black Sabbath on this farewell tour.
We're so lucky to get them twice.
And for people who aren't all that familiar with Black Sabbath, maybe are familiar with Ozzy Osbourne, though, because he turned himself into a reality TV star over the years.
Yeah, sadly. But I'm very excited for this show. These shows, I've never seen Black Sabbath. I've seen Ozzy with his solo band, which was great, but I've never seen Black Sabbath, so I'm glad I get to see them before they're gone for good.
So Black Sabbath will be at the Palace of Auburn Hills on February 19th, and the very next night, the Palace completely shifts gears from hard rock and roll to country music with Blake Shelton. That's on February 20th at the Palace.
Yeah, and the funny thing about Blake is that he was a country star for so long, but it wasn't really until he got on NBC's The Voice that I think he got that mainstream attention.
And, you know, I think here in this part of Michigan anyway, a lot of people started watching The Voice who hadn't before, when Joshua Davis was on the show earlier in 2015. And so a whole new group of viewers were suddenly tuning into who Blake Shelton is as a person, even if they weren't familiar with his music. And now maybe they're checking out his music. And he is one of the biggest stars in country music. He put out a greatest hits package last year called Reloaded, 20 number ones. If he's had 20 number one hits on the country music charts, he's one of the biggest stars there is in country music.
Absolutely. And now, of course, he's dating Gwen Stefani from No Doubt. So there's
and,
that, too.
And also from The Voice.
From The Voice. I was thinking of her from No Doubt.
Yeah, that's right. Well, of course, from No Doubt, solo hits of her own, too. Let's hear a little bit of Blake Shelton music from that greatest hits album that came out last year, Reloaded, 20 number ones, Gunna.
I wanna, it's a damn ride, hold you tight, baby, I'm gonna
Dan Erickson is the Things to Do reporter and music columnist for the Lansing State Journal. Now, Anne, when we get into March, it's really interesting. There are three shows coming up within a four-day span that we're going to talk about all at the Palace of Auburn Hills. The first is on March 20th with AC/DC. Now, last year they played Ford Field. They sold out Ford Field, so they're going to step down, I gather, from the football stadium-type arenas to NBA basketball arenas like the Palace. But if you weren't able to go see them at Ford Field last year, there is another opportunity to see them. And this could be a farewell tour, too.
Yeah, it probably is. A lot of people thought that last year's rock or bust run would be it for them, and then they added this new leg, and we're lucky enough to have them back.
Well, that's March 20th. Two nights later, the Palace switches back to country music. Carrie Underwood will be at the Palace of Auburn Hills on March 22nd. Her tour is called the Storyteller Tour. Carrie Underwood, one of the biggest stars, not just in country music, maybe primarily in country music, but a lot of pop appeal too.
Absolutely. I feel like she's probably the biggest star to come out of American Idol. What do you think?
I think that's probably right. There have been some winners on American Idol that you really don't hear much about, and a few others who finished second or third or fourth who have become pretty big stars. But Carrie Underwood might be the biggest name that American Idol has put out there. And American Idol, of course, is getting into their final season now.
Absolutely. And she seems like a nice person. Mm-hmm. I've never met her. I have no idea. But she just has that nice person vibe.
Well, I don't know if Rihanna would be on your list of nice people. She's got kind of she might be a very nice person.
She seems nice too, actually.
She has a reputation for steamy music, though. She'll be at the Palace on March 24th. So AC/DC on the 20th, Carrie Underwood on the 22nd, and Rihanna's Anti-World Tour on March 24th. We're going to hear a little bit of Rihanna music right now. Here's Umbrella, a song that she put out a while ago with Jay-Z. Now, Anne, the last two concerts we're going to talk about, I can tell you from personal experience, are already sellouts because I tried to buy tickets unsuccessfully.
Hello, it's me.
Adele, yes, Adele, coming to Michigan for two shows in September at the Palace of Auburn Hills, the 6th and 7th of September. The biggest star in the world right now, is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And I knew you would be an Adele fan. You never told me that, but I could just tell.
Well, frankly, the whole family. And I'll bet there are a lot of entire families that love Adele.
Mm-hmm.
So this album, 25, has topped the charts. Hello has topped the charts. She's been on Saturday Night Live. She had her own TV special on NBC during the holidays. Adele, September 6th and 7th at the Palace of Auburn Hills. Ann Erickson is the Things to Do reporter and music columnist for the Lansing State Journal. We'll have you back periodically in 2016 to talk about the concerts that we don't know about yet this early January.
Thank you so much. It's always fun, always great to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming in. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, Hebron glass is a type of hand-blown glass made in the Palestinian West Bank. Saper Galleries in East Lansing says it has the world's largest collection of it outside of the Middle East. We'll hear from Roy Saper of Saper Galleries about the history of this beautiful glass. That's coming up on Current State.
I'm gonna tell God how you treat me. I'm gonna tell God how you treat me one of these days, hallelujah. I'm gonna tell God how you treat me. I'm gonna tell God how you treat me one of these days.
That is Josh White Jr. performing I'm Gonna Tell God How You Treat Me. Josh was here in Studio S a couple of weeks before Christmas for a Live Music Friday performance. Tomorrow we preview a weekend open house at Marshall Music in Lansing. We welcome performer, student, Timothy Wolf to Studio S, really talented young player. And we'll also welcome Marshall Music instructors Hank Horton and Chris Rollins. That is tomorrow on a Current State Live Music Friday. We hope you can join us. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Back in 2012, the MSU Board of Trustees adopted an energy transition plan to guide the university toward a more sustainable future. The ultimate vision was for the university to one day be powered by 100% renewable energy. Joining us in the studio to talk about the progress MSU is making with sustainable energy is physics and astronomy professor Wolfgang Bauer. Mr. Bauer also serves as senior consultant in the Office of the Executive Vice President for Administrative Services. Wolfgang, welcome back.
Morning, Mark.
And if you have a question for our guest, please feel free to tweet us at KAR Current State or email us currentstate@wkar.org. We adopted the energy transition plan in 2012. Remind our listeners what was at the heart of that. What were some of the key goals?
So MSU, of course, consumes a lot of energy, and almost all of it comes from fossil fuels. And a fairly large group of us got together 5, 6, 7 years ago and said, how do we change that? How do we reduce our carbon footprint of the university as a whole? And how do we establish national and international leadership in this area? You know, MSU is one of the top 100 research universities in the world. And I think whatever we do has to be informed by, you know, our position and our claim to provide intellectual leadership for these issues.
What, was there a timeline that was a part of the transition plan?
Yes, there is. And so there's hard goals for 5 years from now, 10 years from now, long-term future. And they were set purposely aggressive, almost to a point where I think there is no realistic ways to meet the goals, but that make us strain to get there.
Mm. Did the timeline include a goal for being carbon free or totally renewable?
No. There is no end date at which we're going to be carbon free. New technology comes on all the time, and we have to be prepared to be nimble and take advantage of these inventions, technology advancements. And so you cannot say, oh, at this day, we're going to try this. With current technology, I would say it's impossible for MSU to be completely carbon neutral.
Well, you talked about hard goals here and hard timelines. Give us an example of one that might be coming up.
So one goal that we could overshoot easily now is reduction in our emissions of CO2. And so let me just set you the scale. What you pay for in your house is a kilowatt hour, right? That's the unit of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And a megawatt hour are just 1,000 of them. And so then you ask yourself, well, how many megawatt hours of electricity does MSU overall, all research, dorms, WKAR, the athletic facilities, how much do all of us consume during a given year? And that number is about 330,000 megawatt hours. And let me also give you a scale. A megawatt hour costs roughly $100, right? So MSU is a big consumer of energy. We produce almost all of this energy by ourselves in the Simon Power Plant. That Simon Plant has served MSU incredibly well for the last 50 years. It's getting a little old in the teeth. We're doing our best to update it, to equip it for modern technology. But these 330,000 megawatt hours, they are supplied by the Simon Power Plant. Emissions go along with that. So when the Simon Power Plant was run all on coal 5, 6, 7 years ago, then one could calculate how much CO2 is emitted through those smokestacks that you see on South Campus.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, the number is about 2 pounds per kilowatt hour, so 2,000 pounds per megawatt hour. When you switch to natural gas, which at first seemed a rather remote possibility, but which we have completed now, almost completed now, I would say, when you switch to natural gas, those emissions go down by 50%. So instead of emitting 2 pounds per kilowatt hour, now you really only emit 1 pound of CO2 per kilowatt hour. So
that's progress.
That is tremendous progress.
Yes.
So let me tell you how much progress that is. If you then say, well, 1 megawatt hour emits 2,000 pounds of CO2 when you burn coal. And now you can plant trees to capture that CO2 again and be carbon neutral, right? So each tree absorbs on the order of 1,000 pounds by growing up over the time span of, say, 20 years. That's sort of an approximate number, right?
Okay.
So what I'm saying here is if you produce 1 megawatt hour of electricity from coal, to compensate for that, you would need to plant 2 trees and not touch that tree in 20 years. Don't cut it down or anything. Just let it grow, suck in the CO2.
Mm.
If you do the same megawatt hour through natural gas, you only need to plant 1 tree. So by going from coal to natural gas, which we have almost completed now, we are saving 330,000 trees per year at MSU.
Mm. You mentioned overshooting the goal CO2.
Yes,
Does that mean you will not make hit the goal that you set for yourselves?
No, we will exceed the goal.
So
we have achieved greater reduction in emissions than what we set out to do.
Mm.
A few years ago when we started with this energy transition plan, coal was actually much cheaper than natural gas. Now the equation has reversed. It's actually cheaper to buy your energy through natural gas, your fossil energy through natural gas than through coal. That is very surprising. And this is almost like, suppose you have a weight loss gain and I tell you, you can eat exactly the same amount of food, but better tasting food, and you will lose the weight, right? You don't have to suffer. You save money and you reduce your emissions. So it's the best of both worlds. This is somewhat of a, I wouldn't say lucky, but it's a fortunate development in the last few years.
We're speaking with MSU Professor Wolfgang Bauer about the Michigan State's progress away from coal and toward more sustainable energy sources. Let's talk about renewable energy. What types of renewable energy are being pursued by Michigan State?
Yeah, so if you want to step away from fossils, eventually you have to generate all your energy with renewables. And so we have looked into basically all kinds. You might think hydro. Hydro is actually the cleanest renewable energy, but we really only have that Red Cedar River flowing through campus, and we can't really put a hydroelectric dam on it. It's much too little energy that you get out. So you could check that off. Hydro doesn't work for us. What else? Wind. So we could put wind turbines on campus. There were some concerns from our College of Agriculture about pollination patterns and also ground vibrations. I'm going to withhold comment.
Pollination patterns?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Okay. Wind blows through campus and carries.
It affects the pollen.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not sure that they're all that founded, but what deterred us from investing in wind turbines is that the wind primarily blows at night. I'm generalizing here, but at night, late evening hours and the morning hours, the wind is the strongest when we need the least electricity. And so this provided some negative incentive for us. Solar is a different, well, it's a different energy form, of course, but it also has advantages that, you know, when we need the most electricity during the daytime peak hours, mm-hmm. the sun shines the most. Mm-hmm. And so this peak shaving is very financially advantageous. And we have signed a contract and we will build 4 or 5 large solar arrays. We didn't want to use agricultural land, so we're just building them above our parking lots, mainly the big commuter lots. So the one at Mount Hope and Farm Lane is the biggest one.
This is a done deal. This is going to happen.
Yes, this will happen. And in the end, it will allow us to generate solar power cheaper than brown power through fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. When will we see that? When will we see that at Mount Hope?
Optimistically, I would say construction will start in 3 months. It should all be done by the end of next year. And then the solar arrays will deliver a combined peak power of something like, I predict, 13 megawatt. Now, how much is that? 13 megawatt is 1/5 of MSU's peak consumption. So
that's not bad.
Yes, that gets you a long way towards
your
goals.
Passive solar panels that are soaking up the solar energy. This has been an interesting discussion. There are topics I'd love to continue here, and we fully intend to. We've been talking with Wolfgang Bauer, MSU professor and senior consultant for the Office of the Vice President, about MSU's progress toward implementing more sustainable and renewable energy resources. Professor Bauer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
WKAR wants to say thanks to the 6,500 individuals and families and more than 100 business sponsors who made donations to WKAR in the last year. Thanks to your commitment, smart content that informs and inspires and engages has a home on the radio, on your mobile device, and online. You make WKAR a great resource for mid-Michigan and beyond. Thank you for your support. Current state 3 times daily on WKAR. Hand-blown glass is created all over the world, but East Lansing is home to a collection of blown glass that's unique. It's called Hebron glass from the Palestinian West Bank city of Hebron, and our producer Katie Cook went to Saper Galleries to see it. Katie, describe Hebron glass for us.
It's really beautiful. It has this colorful, swirled appearance to it, and I really can't wrap my head around how they get it to look that way. And when I spoke to the gallery owner, Roy Saper, about the glass, I came to appreciate its beauty even more because it's so inspiring that something so beautiful is being made in a place in the world that's marked by conflict. I started by asking Roy about the history of the glass.
Hebron glass is remarkable in that it's an art medium that's been around for 2,000 years. And what's interesting and what distinguishes Hebron glass from so many other art forms and art media is it's all centered at one dot on the map, this large globe of ours. Hebron is a very large city, the largest city in the Palestinian West Bank territory, and it's mentioned the Bible dozens of times. And for 2,000 years, artisans there have been creating really unique glass using sand from the Dead Sea, and with the addition of cobalt and other chemicals. And what I'm standing in front of right now is a large selection of this Hebron glass made in the same way that it's been made for millennia, but made by people obviously living today who are doing it in the same style and techniques as their ancestors. And what's remarkable at Hebron glass is, as you look at them, you'll see the style, the finishing, the detail, every aspect of it is totally unique, but highly desirable. They're compelling pieces. You want to hold them. You want to feel them. You want to look at them. And more importantly, I think you want to share them because they are so unique.
Describe for our listeners a little bit more what it looks like. I would describe the coloring as like a marbled effect.
excellent, like a swirl, almost like those of us who are a little bit over the 30, 40, or 50 age range. We had little marbles we played with when we were children, little round balls that were maybe 5/8 of an inch in diameter, up to an inch, and we'd flick them with our thumb, and those had a swirl design in them. The swirl design of those marbles is somewhat similar, though not as unique, as the Hebron glass swirl. So it looks like kind of like a marbled effect if you were baking a cake and you were marbling the frosting or the cake. But this marbling is a beautiful colors. There's purple and there are greens, and then there's a rich cobalt blue. And when these are backlit or there's light underneath, they have a transparency that's outstanding. This bright amber just glows. And there's a swirl design that's made by the artisan who's creating this using this molten taffy-like glass that's brought out of a furnace on the end of this long, hollow metal tube. Total control. It's remarkable how they achieve this exacting technique and style. But what's truly remarkable is that you only see it in Hebron glass. And if you think there have to be thousands of glass blowers around the world, this style of this colorful swirled glass that feels like there's motion in it, it feels alive, it feels organic, you only find this style, this technique from this dot on the map, Hebron, in the Palestinian West Bank. And I'll tell you, I heard about this. I've always known about Hebron glass. And I thought, you know, I'm going to that part of the world, and I'm thinking, I've got to stop there. How could you go halfway around the world and be so close and not go there? So I had that obligation. I needed to go see it.
I was wondering if you knew about the glass before you went to Hebron or if you discovered it when you were there on a trip.
Excellent.
So how did that happen?
Question. Well, a lot of the items we have here, the hand-painted boxes from Brazil and the cocobola wood boxes and bowls that I found in Costa Rica, a lot of the items I've found in travels, I've come across as a total discovery. But this is one of the rare cases where I knew about it, but I've never really seen Hebron glass. And so what I did is I went to Hebron after going to the Middle East, the Palestine area, to pick up one of my sons who was doing an internship there at a non-governmental organization. So my son and my wife and I got in a car, and I was in Israel, and I found what I'm told was the only car that I could drive from Israel into the West Bank without it being a problem or difficulty. It had an Israeli license plate. And I remember the first time I drove this car in, when the rocks started flying because of an Israeli license plate, and I was in Arab country, I realized this was a difficulty. But the most exciting thing was when I discovered this workshop, and I went in and I saw shells of this long lost, not well known Hebron glass there. I could feel my heart. I'm thinking, this is like a discovery. This is like an amazing discovery, because I knew that it would be very rare to find this glass in America. And I made it a commitment at that time to bring a very significant large collection of Hebron glass back to America, back to Michigan, and back to Saper Galleries in downtown East Lansing, so I'd be able to share it with those who enjoy discoveries as I do.
I'm here at Saper Galleries in East Lansing speaking with the owner, Roy Saper, about their extensive collection of Hebron glass. In fact, it's the largest collection in the world outside the Middle East. So you had some trouble bringing that large amount of glass back to the States, is that right?
Katie, it is a little almost amusing, but now in retrospect. But I said to the packers as they were packing up the several dozen Hebron glass vases, vessels, pitchers, and decanters that I selected, I said, pack them up, I'll come back in a couple hours and I'll take them. And they gave me a look that said, Roy, you don't know what you're talking about. This is the Palestinian West Bank. And to get out of the Palestinian West Bank, one has to go into Israel. And at the checkpoints, they won't let you through with these boxes, because Israel is protective of its country and doesn't want anything in its country that could be harmful or put the citizens of the state of Israel at risk. So my family, my son, one son, and my wife left Hebron without these boxes, and I was told they were going to be shipped to us. But when we we're at a checkpoint. My wife and I were separated from our sons because, not because of the Hebron glass, but because someone had given as a gift to my son a book. That book was the Quran. And as soon as my son acknowledged it was his, more armed forces came out, so we were surrounded. They took my wife and I, and they put us in a metal holding cell, and they detained us for 3 or 4 hours. They would ask my son a bunch of questions, and then the interrogators would come to us and ask us questions. And I remember at one point they're bringing some other Arabs into the prison, and they looked at us and they looked at the guards and they asked the guards, "What are you doing? They're Americans. They are funding your whole operation. Let them out of here." But the Israelis, the Israeli Defense Forces, they go through all the motions to ensure that their country or their state is not put at risk. So it was a difficult situation. I'd encourage others to do a little search and learn more about Hebron and the West Bank to see that the freedoms that we enjoy here in America and in Michigan are such a contrast to what is in many parts of the world.
This collection of glass is available to be viewed year-round, is that right?
Yes, our intent is to always have them. We welcome people to come and visit and enjoy them directly.
And we should mention that they're for sale, and some of them are quite reasonably priced. Also, speaking of the translucents, the first time I saw them, I was really tempted to find a way to put a candle inside because they've got the beautiful color and you can see through them.
I'm going to show you. Let's take this. I'm holding now a beautiful single-handle pitcher that's in these beautiful waves of purple colors and amber and green and blue. And I'm walking over to a turntable here that has a light underneath. I just flick the LED light on, and tell me what you see now.
Oh, wow. It changes the color of it.
It's totally. It's glowing. It's glowing. It has this inner glow, bright effervescence that's translucent when a light source is put underneath it. But still, it's beautiful as it stands without. But isn't this remarkable?
It really is.
It's totally remarkable. I'm so excited. I love sharing them. And people are enjoying them in their own homes on display as well.
For Current State, I'm Katie Cook.
The new year may be all about looking forward and setting goals, but this week's book review is taking us back in time. Here's Scott Southard with his review of the historical novel The Marriage of Opposites by Alice Hoffman.
Historical fiction authors have to walk a thin line. On the one hand, they want to avoid writing a book so caught up in historical detail that readers feel like they've opened a textbook. But they also don't want to lose what makes the genre interesting, with a story that totally ignores the time period in which it's set. In her new novel, The Marriage of Opposites, Alice Hoffman walks this tightrope with ease. The book is filled with beautiful, lyrical writing and characters so real that it's not surprising they once lived and breathed. Hoffman manages to capture the spirit of a past time and place with writing that still feels exciting and fresh. The Marriage of Opposites is the story of Rachel Pumier, a Jewish immigrant living on the island of St. Thomas in the early 1800s. Rachel is a dreamer and a firebrand. She is constantly keeping the people around her guessing what she will say or do next. As a young woman, Rachel dreams of visiting Paris and falling in love. But those plans are dashed when she is forced into an arranged marriage with a widower much older than her. At this point, many readers will hope that Rachel will run away and seek out her dreams. It feels like this arrangement will ruin the character we have fallen in love with. But she doesn't leave. Instead, she and her husband form a friendship for the sake of his children and accept that they will never find love in their arrangement. One of the wonders of Hoffman's writing is how alive she makes the world around Rachel feel. Throughout the story of Rachel's life, the island of St. Thomas is just as much a character as any of the others on the page. Everything about it feels vivacious, from the smells in the air to the overbearing heat that makes less prepared arrivals faint. It is a land of superstitions and magic, the kind of place where after calling a doctor, you stop by the local mystic for an herbal cure. It will be hard for readers not to immediately book a plane ticket to the island after reading Hoffman's masterpiece. Usually, When you read historical fiction, you expect the main character to play a part in something groundbreaking. Maybe they're a key player in a war or some cultural upheaval. But that's not what Hoffman gives us in this book. Instead, she shows us how an ordinary person can influence a great talent. When Rachel falls in love after the death of her first husband, she is vilified. The man who wins her heart isn't just younger than her. He's also the nephew of her deceased husband. In the eyes of the church, everything about their love is a sin. Yet, the product of that forbidden love will be Camille Pissarro, who many consider the founder of Impressionism. Hoffman doesn't focus on the important figures who make it into the history book, but on the people who inspire them. In doing so, she digs deep into the lives and decisions that shape our history, but are often forgotten. It's not often I wish a book didn't have to end, but that's exactly how I felt about The Marriage of Opposites. I wanted to follow the stories of each of Rachel's children, not just Camille. Is there a greater compliment that I can give a book about historical figures than saying I felt like I knew them? Because I did, and you will too. When I reached the last page of The Marriage of Opposites, it was like saying goodbye to an old friend. And while I probably won't run into Rachel Pumier again, I do hope it's not the last I see of Alice Hoffman. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
And that's our show for today. Glad you could join us. Please join us tomorrow for a Live Music Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore for Current State on WKAR.